Hello, friends. Dr. Barry, I'm back with you with another live interview with a special guest that I think you're going to really enjoy. You guys have heard me say many, many times that if you have vegetable oil in your kitchen, that you need to pause this video, get up right now, go to the kitchen and throw it in the garbage. Don't even give it to charity. Don't give it to your neighbor unless you hate your neighbor. And so we're going to be talking about with Tucker Goodrich, who, in my opinion, has studied the issue of omega-6 fatty acids, polyunsaturated fatty acids, and vegetable seed oils as thoroughly, if not more thoroughly, than pretty much anybody else in the space. So without further ado, let's bring Tucker on. And you guys are welcome. If you know anybody who still believes that vegetable oil, margarine, Crisco, plant butter, that's the new thing. If you know someone, you care about them, and they still believe that's healthy, please share this video with them, because you could literally save their life, add years to their life by sharing this video with them. Welcome, Tucker.
Pleasure, Ken. Great. I don't know if you recall, we met up in Connecticut at Keto Fest a couple of years ago.
It's been a minute. Yeah, hopefully we'll get to meet up again at a conference one day soon, but somehow more and more I doubt that might ever happen. I don't know. So I think virtual, we need to capitalize on virtual. So before we get started, give everybody just the quick and dirty rundown on kind of how you came to think, you know, polyunsaturated fats, I think they're very important. I need to research that. Tell us a little bit about you and why you decided that.
Well, I had a bunch of health problems when I was in my late 30s, early 40s. I, up until that point, had followed what I thought was a healthy diet. I referred to myself, to my poor daughters, as Mr. Whole Wheat. And it wasn't until I had started following a blogger, Stefan Guionet, and he convinced me that seed oils was something of concern, mainly because of the skin cancer risk. And one day I went, you know, I was, so at this point I'd had been diagnosed initially with a stroke when I was 38, spent 4 days in a stroke ward. I had had acute diverticulitis, which resulted in a perforated colon and another couple of periods in the hospital leading up to a colon resection. I'd had a bunch of other visits to the hospital, which were all either inexplicable or chalked up to aging. So, you know, there I am lying on my back in a hospital intensive care unit, reading on my phone about acute diverticulitis. And it says, this is typically a disease of old age. 80% of people in their 80s have diverticula, but it may hit people as young as 40 years of age. Well, I was 2 weeks past my 40th birthday. So my plan to live to a ripe old age, as my parents and grandparents had, was somewhat on the skids. So, you know, I started following this blogger, Stefan Guionet, who at the time was a PhD student, and he convinced me. You know, I read all of his posts. At the time, I was in Wall Street, and I was the CTO of a large hedge fund. So my job was problem solving and doing research and making sure that I made, on behalf of my firm, the correct decisions about where we were going to invest our money and how we were going to operate. So I was pretty confident in my ability to figure things out.
And I absolutely love it when we have people who come to the medical or the nutrition space from other areas of expertise. You are a great example. Dave Feldman is a great example. Ivor Cummings is a great example. When you bring somebody that's obviously very intelligent, very bright, very quick, and very good at problem solving, when you bring them to medicine or nutrition and you just hand them our problems, which to us seem incomprehensible and insurmountable. Like, I don't know. We've been dealing with this my entire career. I just don't know what in the world to make of this. When you bring fresh eyes and a fresh brain to that, very often you guys can just look at this and go, well, duh, dummy, look at this, this, and this. There you go. You're welcome. See you later.
Well, and, you know, in fairness, that's true in any field.
Yes.
I mean, you know, every single field has, what was the analogy I heard the other day? The guy said the electric light bulb wasn't invented by candle makers, right?
100%. That's exactly right. Yeah. And that's a great analogy. So anybody who's watched me on YouTube, Facebook, anywhere, watch me fight on Twitter, they know that I am a huge proponent of avoiding vegetable oils in all permutations. And we're going to talk about in this video, I hope, why I'm so vehement about that, why I'm just, there's no wiggle room at all there. And so where do you just pick up and take off running?
Yeah. So just to finish that little story. So one day I'm down in the cafeteria at the office and I go to the end of the salad line, you know, cause that was my general lunch was either a salad, or a whole wheat sandwich on whole wheat bread. And, you know, I'd been sugar-free since I was in my teens because of my cavity issues. God bless that dentist and who told me to do that. And so I get to the end of the salad bar line and I look at the salad dressings in these squeeze bottles and I think to myself, you know, this has just got to be the worst crap commodity oil that they can, you know, the cheapest thing they can stick in a squeeze bottle. And I'm like, so what happens to me if I actually stop eating this right now? So I put some vinegar on my salad and no dressing, and that was the beginning. And at that point, I had suffered from inflammatory bowel disease for 16 years, chronic diarrhea. That resolved in 2 days. I forgot to eat carbohydrates. I'd tried going, you know, I was the typical pound a year overweight guy. And I tried to go on a low carb diet and I could never get over the carbohydrate cravings. Forgot to eat carbohydrates for a week. Just never occurred to me, right? Didn't even think about it until the following week when I had another sandwich on whole wheat bread and I had this horrible reaction to the wheat. And then I discovered I had this gluten intolerance problem also. And then, you know, so that combination was really an eye opener. And I didn't understand why it had had such a dramatic effect on me. And I wanted to know how. And then as my health rapidly improved, everybody at work started asking me, what are you doing differently? Why have you lost so much weight? Why do you look so much younger? You know, over the course of 2 months. So it was dramatic enough so that people noticed it. I started looking into it and, you know, unfortunately went down the rabbit hole. And the more and more I discovered about it, the more and more I realized what an effect this could have on family and colleagues, and then on people that I met online who I was able to have a big influence on. So, you know, here I am 10 years later.
Yeah, absolutely. And we're glad that you're here. Everybody's commenting that your beard is sexier than mine. And I grew this. I tried to grow this just to compete with you, but obviously you've kicked my ass. So I'm just going to give it up and go back down to the goat because you've embarrassed me, Tucker. We've got tons of questions.
Flattery will get you everywhere.
Tons of questions saying, what's the best diet for IBS? And I would say, avoid all vegetable seed oils, avoid all grains, and probably you need to avoid any liquid dairy less fatty than half and half. Would you agree with that? Add or subtract anything?
Dairy's a big question. There's clear evidence in the medical literature indicating why a high seed oil diet is problematic for gut health. So, I mean, that's not even both epidemiological and mechanistic. So that one's not even really a question.
Yep.
You know, it's indicated in the pathogenesis of colon cancer. Colon cancer obviously generally follows from irritable bowel disease. It's thought to be inflammatory in nature, and the toxins that seed oils break down into clearly induce inflammation. So, you know, it's, yeah, you eat a carcinogen and you get colon cancer, you shouldn't be shocked.
And exactly. And I heard you talking on another video that when researchers are trying to get the rodent model to develop cancer, it's almost required that they give them vegetable seed oils or the constituents thereof. Explain that to us a little bit.
Well, so there are three different models I'm aware of where that's the case. There may be more, but you know, not a lot of people have looked into it. But when the title is the when they use the word required in a scientific paper, that's typically pretty significant. So just today, I was looking at a paper looking at skin cancer, and they found that in order for DNA lesions in skin cancer to progress to tumors, linoleic acid above a tiny little amount is required in the diet, right? And the effect is blocked by saturated fat. So, you know, and then same thing in a breast cancer model, you want to give the poor little mice breast cancer and it's required in the diet. You start looking at traditional human populations. There's a population called the Wayuu in the high Andes desert in Colombia. They have a lot of basal cell carcinoma, which, as you know, is the least dangerous form of cancer. They have no squamous cell cancer or melanoma. These are people who live in the desert and at altitude and typically wear no shirts. And they're typically manual laborers, so they're outside all the time. So by the standard medical model of what causes skin cancer, you know, they should be covered in tumors. And they're not. Why? And that should, you know, A, why is that the case? And B, why should that surprise us? We evolved in Africa, for heaven's sake.
Right.
And while a blonde-haired, blue-eyed guy like me is probably going to be more susceptible to UV damage than, you know, I mean, you know, if you think about it, the Bushmen in Africa are not, they're brown, they're not black, right?
Right.
So there's a certain melanin necessity for protection for skin cancer, but it doesn't explain why all of these populations, every population around the world is seeing steadily increased rates of skin cancer.
Yep. I totally agree. And I actually talk about that in my book, Lies My Doctor Told Me. I have a chapter about just the ridiculous recommendations that modern medicine makes about how to prevent skin cancer. You know, wear sunscreen, even if you're indoors, and just foolishness. A lot of the research was done on donated human foreskins. So it wasn't even living tissue. It was dead neonatal penis tissue. That's what they did a lot of the research on. So in no way is that a model that then you could apply to actually living skin. And actually talk about this population that you mentioned earlier. These people are in the sun all day, every day, with their shirt off, working hard and sweating.
Right.
And they have less melanoma than people who work indoors full time. And so people who are basically never exposed to the sun, and they probably have their SPF 80 on when they are, these guys had less of the dangerous kind of skin cancer.
Well, they had none. So yeah, that's quite a lot less.
Yeah. So, but you know, when you say none, people are like, well, that can't be true. There's got to be a 0.01 or something. But yeah, you're right. They actually had none at all.
Right.
And the rates were quite high in people who worked indoors.
That was from a paper published in Military Medicine by the US Navy. So it's not like it's the Columbia Board of Tourism publishing this paper. It's somebody who has absolutely no reason to be anything but objective.
Right. And yeah, Coach Yee says donated foreskin. And I was using that word colloquially. The parents of the infant by proxy donated the foreskin. The infant,
yeah, I was going to say, nobody asked me.
Yeah, the infant was not able to give his consent. So yes, I get the irony of your comment. So I was going to save this for later, but I think we're talking about skin cancer. Let's talk about this, Tucker. When I was first starting a ketogenic diet, I'm as almost as white as you can get. I'm so white I'm red, a lot like you are. And my DNA is very Nordic, lots of German, Scotch, Irish. I have more Neanderthal DNA than 97% of the population. And when I went to the beach, I was the guy who would tell his phone to wake him up in 7 minutes, because after 7 minutes of playing with my kids on the beach, I had to go get under the umbrella for the remainder of the day, or I would have a second degree skin burns that, and then I would have a reaction. It just ruined vacation after vacation after vacation. But I noticed after I was going keto that I could stay in the sun twice as long initially. And it's like, and I might get a little pink, but I didn't burn. And then eventually it was even longer. It was three times. I could stay three or four times as long without burning. And now I don't even think about the sun. If the sun's out, if the sun's not out, I just go play outside. And I know that you had a similar experience. And I don't think there's anything magic about the keto diet, because what I was doing when I was going to a ketogenic diet was I was eliminating certain things from my diet, and I was adding in other things from my diet, things that ultimately my skin cell membranes were going to be made out of. And I think that's probably what happened. Walk us through this, Tucker, and help us understand why people, especially on a carnivore diet, and a lot of people on keto, if it's meat heavy, how are they able to stay in the sun longer without burning?
Well, I went through the same thing several weeks after dropping seed oils from my diet. I went skiing in March on a blue sky sunny day, and I hate sunscreen. So much like you, I would set a timer, or I'd wear a hat, or, you know, just avoid the sun, because I would turn into a tomato in like 45 minutes. So, you know, I'm out there all day, and at the end of the day, I come home, and next morning I look in the mirror and I'm like, I'm not burned. Interesting. And, you know, as I said, I'd read a couple of accounts of this, but it didn't really click. And then speaking of Colombia, several weeks after that, my now ex-wife, who is Colombian, and I went to an event in New York City, and we stood out in the sun side by side for 2.5 hours. She's dark skin. And we got home, and she looked at me, and she said, look at what a burn I got from today. And I looked at her, and I looked at myself, and I said, I didn't burn at all. And now that, side by side, and she was a beach person, and I would avoid the beach, and all of a sudden, in a matter of weeks, the tables had been turned. That was probably the most amazing thing. I mean, you know, for somebody like me, that it's been life-altering. I mean, so here we are, you know, 10-plus years later. I live in Idaho in high desert, and I'm out mountain biking and backpacking all day. And, you know, I want to be clear to people, right? I am still susceptible to sunburn, but now instead of 45 minutes, it's 5 or 6 hours if I haven't had any sun exposure that season, 8 or 9 hours if I am, you know, if I've been out in the sun. So,
yep.
I go backpacking up in the mountain, and I'm out all day, and I don't even own sunscreen. That's not fair. I have some in my ski bag, and I haven't used it since 2012.
Yeah, I'm routinely out on the farm working in the sun for hours every day, and it seems like I'm able to get more of an actual brownish tan now. Yes. Whereas in the past, when I was eating the standard American diet, I was not going to get brown. I might get bright red, but there was going to be no brownness whatsoever.
Yeah, and you go pink.
Yeah.
Well, this is what happens to me. I go pink, and then I wake up the next morning and I'm tan.
Yep.
Which is the way you would expect it to work, right?
Yeah, it's almost like that's how it's supposed to work. Yeah,
it's like we evolved under the sun. I mean, it's miraculous.
So what changes in our diet increased our ability to enjoy sunlight and benefit from it? And how exactly do you think what's the mechanism of that?
Well, let me start with the mechanism, because the mechanism is pretty clear in the experimental models. How much polyunsaturated fat you feed these animals controls how susceptible they are to burn and to skin cancer. This has been replicated in humans with antioxidants to the extent that you can, because obviously you can't give people skin cancer. But there's an antioxidant called astaxanthin, which is a red pigment, essentially, that's in shrimp and things. And if you feed that to people, it protects them from lipid peroxidation, which is a science code word for omega-6 fats breaking down. And you know, it, that pigment protects you, that antioxidant protects you from sunburn. And they've got neat little charts, you know, in the paper showing the difference and showing how much more protected these people are. And it, you know, if you go back to the animal models, it's, you know, it's quite clear. It's the omega-6 fats break down into these toxins. They cause DNA damage, including damage to the P53 anti-tumor gene. And, you know, then you're off to the races. So if you go on a keto diet or any low-carb diet, one of the first things that you're doing is you're cutting out carbohydrates. And carbohydrates in the American diet, almost processed food, almost always comes with omega-6 fats, right? Because they've been very diligent about following the dietary guidelines and getting saturated fat out. So bread is no longer made with butter. It's made with some sort of vegetable oil, cake, the same, you know. In the good old days, it used to be Crisco, which is actually better in a lot of ways than these straight seed oils, but that's what they're using nowadays. So right there, you're cutting a lot of omega-6 out of your diet. And there's also a negative effect of hyperglycemia, excess blood sugar, on the breakdown of omega-6 fats. So, and additionally, if you go on a keto diet, you can actually burn the toxins that are generated in the breakdown of omega-6 fats for fuel. If you're on a carnivore diet, or if you up your intake of beef a lot, you're getting carnosine, the most damaging breakdown product of omega-6 fats. And as far as skin cancer goes, is this thing called 4-hydroxynonenal, HNE. And the best protector we have, the best antioxidant we have against that toxin is carnosine. And the best source of carnosine is beef. So beef is the double whammy, right? You're getting less omega-6 because ruminants don't absorb omega-6 the same way that a chicken or a pig does. Right. And you're getting this highly effective antioxidant against these toxins. So yeah, it's, you know, all the carnivore people. I mean, I used to have this conversation with Sean Baker all the time, and, you know, I went through the mechanism, and we did a big thing on Twitter several years ago, like, okay, everybody, tell us how many anecdotes can we collect of this? And it's a lot of people. It's a lot of people. And probably the best anecdote, so I was just at the Ancestral Health Symposium, which was started by a scientist at UCLA named Aaron Blaisdell. Aaron is of Ashkenazi Jewish extraction, so he... his people evolved in the desert, basically. And he had this condition called porphyria, which is, quote, you know, supposedly it's a genetic condition, right? But it is a super susceptibility to sun damage. So his skin would start to blister in minutes, and he would have to wrap himself in canvas and denim to go out in the sun. He did a anthropology dig when he was in college, and, you know, was just like, how am I going to do this? I'm going to, you know, get roasted, literally. You know, you and I think we have it bad.
Yeah.
So he started the Ancestral Health Symposium after he found out about the paleo diet, changed his diet. And when I saw him in LA this year, he's tan. And we went for a walk out in the sun for half an hour. No problem.
Yep.
So he's put a genetic condition in remission entirely by changing his diet. And I asked him, what do you think it is? And he said, well, originally I thought it was probably wheat and seed oils, but now I think it's definitely seed oils.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, there's quite a bit of a debate in the keto carnivore community. Is it the carbs? Is it the seed oils? And I tell people, I love it that we're having productive debate, because I think that's how any knowledge increases and advances. That's a good thing. And if 10 years from now, the seed oil guys win and it's not the carbs, I will immediately stand up and say, thank God it's not the carbs, because I love carbs. Right.
Well,
or vice versa. And so, but what I think that what I try to do with the Proper Human Diet, Tucker, is I try to get people to mimic the diet that we ate more than 20,000 years ago. So basically before the agricultural revolution, which I don't think we did voluntarily. I think we were forced to do that because of a catastrophic event that probably be the great topic to talk about one day. But before 20,000 years ago, we were our omega 6 to omega 3 ratio intake was 1 to 1, maybe 1 to 2, 1 to 3, maybe if you lived near the coast, it was 1 to 4, maybe. But it was, you know, the average American now, their omega 6 to omega 3 is 20 to 1. 15, yeah. And I've got a chart that says 15 to 1, but I've actually done the math on some people's diets. It's 30, 35 to 1 omega 6 over omega 3 fatty acids. Right. And what people don't realize is they think your body just digests that and it just goes away. Your cell membranes actually will inappropriately use these omega-6 fatty acids as part of the lipid bilayer, and that's going to lead to cell dysfunction.
Well, I wouldn't say, I don't know, inappropriately is not the right word. I think what we have to recognize is that prior to the introduction of the industrial diet, these were rare fats, right?
Yes.
And there are benefits. I mean,
heart... Yes, definitely.
Right. Yep. Your heart, for instance, preferentially accumulates these fats because it allows it to run more efficiently.
Yes, right? And there are essential omega-6 fatty acids.
Well, that's another question. Maybe we'll get into that. But I mean, but the thing is, because they were rare, we never evolved any sort of a rate limiter, right? So, I mean, if you drink too much water, you will get sick and throw up, right? If you eat too much salt, you will want to gag. If you've ever spilled salt on your eggs in the morning, you know. Nope. But we don't really, until we get up to super high levels of omega-6 intake, we don't have a rate limiter, right? There's no part of our body that says, except interestingly, the brain that says, enough, stop, right? The brain does do that. And the brain is the one part of our body that is most susceptible to oxidative damage from fats like these breaking down. And I think it's really interesting that that's the one place where, you know, we've got a rate limiter. The brain preferentially avoids these fats.
And you think that in our previous life on this planet, we were never exposed to polyunsaturated fatty acids to the degree that we needed to develop some kind of defense mechanism against them. They were so rare in our environment that
Well, you know, we only started getting seed oils out of sesame seed 5,000 years ago in India, right? That's the blink of an eye in evolutionary time. Right. And right. You know, there are indications in India of evolution to a vegetarian diet with higher amounts of seed oils, but the adaptation is to convert the short chain omega-6 fats that you get from plant fats into the longer chain omega-6 fats that you get from meat. Right? So we do have an adaptation telling us that this is not ideal for us. But yeah, I haven't seen, there's actually the bigger evolutionary, the biggest mutation in this biggest single point mutation in humanity is something called the ALDH 2-star-2 mutation, which is the Asian flush mutation, right? So we've all heard or seen people of Chinese or Japanese descent who drink alcohol and their face flushes red, right? Well, they can't detoxify alcohol. Right. So they tend to avoid alcohol. That mutation also makes them more susceptible to seed oil toxicity. And I can't help but wonder if they didn't get that mutation because they were on a high rice diet, and rice is a really high source of omega-6 fats. And maybe that's, you know, making them switch to white rice may have been some sort of protective adaptation against a high omega-6 diet. And you know, that's a major factor over there. 50% of Chinese people and like 40% of Japanese people have that mutation. And those people are more susceptible to all the diseases that I think are coming from excess omega-6 fat intake because they can't detoxify it.
Yep. I love that information. That's excellent. We're getting great feedback in the comments. Guys, if you have any specific questions for Tucker or I about this topic, feel free to type them in the comments. Also, if you know someone suffering from any of the conditions that we've talked about, you're welcome to share this video. I want to ask you, this may be a bit controversial, Tucker. You're a smart
guy. Oh, I love controversy.
You're a smart guy. And you know that any large corporation is going to have some degree of intelligence at the top. Now, that could be debated how much. So I think it's pretty clear when you look at the totality of the research on polyunsaturated fatty acids, the omega-6 to omega-3 questions, all these things, it's pretty clear that a diet high in polyunsaturated fatty acids, in omega-6 fatty acids, is not healthy for human beings. Yet, these oils are very, very inexpensive to manufacture.
Yes.
Pseudo foods with, and they also, it's very stable because bacteria and bugs don't want to eat things that aren't real food, so they're very shelf stable. They'll stay on a tanker ship or a grocery store shelf for months and months and months, and they seem to be fresh, right? Do you think?
Well, there's an interesting point there. They seem to be fresh because we can't smell. You know, think about fish. When fish goes rancid, it's the omega-3 fats that are breaking down, and right. You smell it, right? When omega-6 fats break down, it's not a nasty smell. That's why they use them in shelf as shelf stable. They do go bad, but we don't notice it.
So they're still going rancid. They're still oxidizing, but yes. We just can't detect it.
Right. I mean, imagine if you had French fries cooked in or potato chips cooked in fish oil, and you opened up the bag 6 months later.
Oh, yeah. That'd be rough. So my question is, do you think that the PhD level food scientists, the chemists, the nutritionists who work for these multi-billion dollar corporations, they have had to stumble over some of this research that you and I have read? Is it just their non-disclosure and their non-competes and their NDAs that are keeping them silent about this? Or do they just honestly don't know, and they believe that all these foods filled with soybean oil and canola oil and safflower oil, do they believe that they are truly not only safe but healthy, heart healthy, healthier than lard? Do they truly believe that? What do you think's going on at the top of the food pyramid?
Well, okay. We have to remember why we started, right? When we started eating these, it was in the late 1800s. And the scientists at the time took cottonseed oil, which was an industrial waste product, and they figured out how to basic, you know, it's acutely toxic, cottonseed oil. And they figured out how to detoxify it. And they genuinely thought that they had solved a problem, because at the time we were running out of animal fats, right? So along comes this thing that looks clean. It comes out of a lab. You know, the progressive movement was just becoming a thing, and everybody wanted to be scientific, and Crisco really capitalized on that. So, you know, in their defense, they thought they had solved a problem. And it wasn't until the 1950s and 60s that we really started to understand some of the toxic effects of these fats. And it wasn't until, just to put this in perspective, 2011, when the mechanism of these fats turning into toxins in your cells was understood. Okay. So do they know about it? Absolutely. Okay. The best source, if you want to read about the problems with omega-6 fats, is to go read the oil industry literature. They know without any question the toxic problems that these things cause. And they've been working to fix it for decades, right? So they have been breeding high oleic sunflower oil, right? They've been creating GMO soybean oil. My single favorite paper, or rather article in the industry press, said DuPont came out with this GMO soybean oil called Plenish. And the headline was, Plenish is less obesogenic than regular soybean oil. So they know damn well what's going on here, right? And I have interviewed myself scientists who've been involved in the food industry. And, you know, I mean, it was quite hilarious because I often feel like I come across as a bit of a zealot. I didn't hold a candle to these guys. I mean, there was a major English oil scientist who I listened to. He gave a speech, and at the end of it, I asked him, I said, you know, you mentioned something about excess linoleic acid. Can you expand upon that a little bit? And he was like, we have to get this out of our diet. I was like, whoa, dude. So they absolutely know, and they are working on it. But the problem we have is that we're in this huge hole where a huge percentage of our calories, you know, from 7 to 20% is coming from seed oils.
Yep.
And we can't stop producing them tomorrow. I mean, if we turned off the spigot tomorrow, we would have, you know, famine in a lot of places.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it would be the disproportionately, it would be the poor people, the poorest of the poor who suffer, because that's who by far is eating the highest percentage of vegetable seed oils.
That's absolutely right. So industry knows, you know, the problem is breeding programs and GMO programs take time. We're looking at potentially some better solutions right around the pike. The big question is going to be, how much can it scale up? But ultimately, what we all need to do as consumers is vote with your pocketbook, right? Be willing to spend a little bit more for a high oleic oil versus a cheaper oil. Vote with your pocketbook. Industry will produce what we want to buy.
Absolutely. And I'm a big proponent of animal fats, Tucker. I don't know if you, if you're an animal fat guy or if you, I think that avocado oil, olive oil, and coconut oil are not bad. I think they're okay. But I hear a lot of people who have a little bit of an inflammatory response to avocado and olive. I just use animal fats. What do you say about, what's your favorite fats to cook with, to eat with, to season with?
Pastured butter. I have a jar of California olive oil that I use occasionally. I'll go through, like, I think it's like a 32-ounce bottle. That'll last me a year. And I buy Mark Sisson's avocado oil mayonnaise for the, you know, some. Yep. I mean, I started out by making my own mayo, and it's kind of a hassle. And that's,
it really is.
For the amount of it I eat, that's very convenient for me.
Yep.
The problem with the olive oil and the avocado oil markets, as I'm sure you've explained, is that there's a lot of corruption, and it's really tough to know that you're actually getting what you think you are getting. So even just natural olive oil, pure olive oil, can vary in linoleic acid content from 2% to 22%. So that's a big range. 2%, that's great. 22%, I'm not a fan, but there's no way that you can tell what you're getting from the supermarket. There was, you know, a thing going around called the fridge test. Sadly, I used to do that myself, but I've since found out that sadly it doesn't work.
Yep. I try to tell people on my channel, don't ever eat an oil or cook with an oil that's more than 20% polyunsaturated fatty acid. And that way, chicken fat can just barely squeak in under the line, because I really think any animal fat is going to always be better than a highly processed vegetable seed oil. And chicken fat's probably not the best fat, but there are some people out there who love it. And I think it's 1,000 times better than canola oil or soybean oil.
Yeah. So the problem with animal fats is chickens and pigs and people all concentrate omega-6 fats.
Yep.
So if you can get like pastured chicken or pastured pork, unfortunately, it's very expensive. That's probably a good option. But, you know, chicken fat and pork fat can easily be up in the 30 plus percent linoleic acid range. Yep. I mean, I read one thing that said that the biggest source of linoleic acid in the American diet for the average person is chicken, right? Which is, of course, what we've been told to eat all these years. And I'll, you know, just so I'll come to the defense of industry a little bit just because they have been trying to fix it. The folks I don't have much patience for are the government via the dietary guidelines and folks in the medical profession who just go along with this. I mean, I'll point my finger specifically at the Harvard School of Public Health, where out of one side of their mouth, they tell you seed oils are good for you. Out of the other side of their mouth, they say, don't eat fried food, it'll kill you. Exactly what do they think this stuff is fried in? I mean, seriously, have they ever been to a kitchen, right? Fried food is bad for you because it's fried in seed oils.
Exactly. There's nothing magical about just the act of frying something in grease. That there's nothing bad about that. It's what you're frying it in.
Exactly. And again, you go back to the industry literature, they're perfectly clear about the dangers of frying, you know, of what's wrong with a potato chip or a French fry, right? It's fried in seed oils, which turns into toxic aldehydes, and you eat it and you absorb those things, and they are carcinogens. End of story. This isn't complicated, right?
I totally agree.
You know, so great. Harvard tells you not to eat those too, and they do write papers about how bad it is for you and how it causes obesity and type 2 diabetes and heart disease. And then they turn around and they say, oh, but eat your polyunsaturated fats. What do they think we're going to do with it? It's cooking oil, for heaven's sake.
You're going to cook with it, and you're going to maybe pour it on your salad.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, it's beyond me.
Somebody just posted up beef tallow is 40% saturated fat, 50% MUFA, 10% omega-3 and omega-6. That's not true. It's typically in the low single digits.
Yeah.
And I bought a 5-gallon drum of beef tallow back in the day to deep fry stuff in, and you had to get it out of the drum with a chisel and a hammer.
Yes,
it's the consistency of soap.
Yep. And so I think Tucker and I both agree that if you buy inappropriately raised animals, inappropriately processed and inappropriately cooked animals, they are going to be less nutritious, possibly more inflammatory, probably because of the amount, the omega-6 to omega-3 ratio contained in their meat, especially monogast like chickens and pigs. And humans are also monogastric. Right. We don't typically eat humans, so that we don't have to talk about that. But it matters more what you feed a monogastric animal, a chicken or a pig. It really matters in their meat if they're pastured and properly raised and properly fed.
And that's, you know, there's an easy way to understand this process that we're talking about here. And that's, somebody just asked a question, what about local grass-fed beef? So here's what you do. You go to the supermarket and get a grass-fed steak and hold it next to a conventionally grain-finished steak, okay? The grain-finished steak is bright red. The grass-fed is dark red. That color difference is what we call inflammation, right? And the grass-finished steak, the muscle is going to be quite lean and there's going to be fat around the edge. That's normal. The grain-finished steak is going to have fat marbled all through the muscle tissue.
Yeah, that's marbled. You're going to have fatty muscle.
That's what the USDA tells us is prime beef, grade A prime beef, right? They measure it by how marbled it is. That happens, you know, unfortunately, it happens to cows, but it also happens to us by eating the exact same thing that we feed to cows, grains and seed oils. They feed them because it's fatteners, it makes them fatty, and it makes them inflamed. I love grass-fed beef, but, you know, it can be expensive. Fortunately, the difference between grass-fed beef and grain-finished beef in terms of the PUFA content is pretty small. If you're eating grain-finished beef, eat some fish. That's it. Just eat some fish with it. And, you know, if you can't afford the price difference, don't lose sleep over it. Just eat a little bit more fish. If you're lucky and you're able to eat nothing but grass-finished beef and pastured butter and pastured dairy and pastured pork and chickens, then you don't have to worry about you know, the fish, you're going to be getting all the omega-3 fats that you need through that. Lamb's a great source because lamb is typically I think always grass finished.
Yep. That's why I've got a pasture full of them right now, Tucker, is because I've got plans for them in the future.
Oh yeah.
So you're saying if somebody, if they can only afford the cheapest beef at the supermarket, and you know, I mean, money's money, man. I used to be broke as a joke. I totally understand. Then you would recommend adding what, some canned salmon to their diet to kind of try to get the omega-6 to omega-3 ratio back to a more ancestral ratio?
Right. And like, you know, not a lot. You know, I personally love sardines. I go through phases where I'm eating sardines every day and then I won't touch it for a couple of months. But, you know, fatty, even non-fatty fish is still going to have more omega-3 than most land animals will just based on what they're eating. Yeah. And, you know, I mean, at one point I was curious about this and I was going to the supermarket and I was trying to figure out, you know, food price per pound. Ground beef is just about the cheapest, most nutritious thing in the supermarket. I mean, ground beef per pound is about half the price of lettuce.
And for the nutrient density. Yeah. And for the nutrient density, per ounce, the price, you almost can't beat the cheapest stick of ground beef at the grocery. That's it. That's the superfood. If all you can buy is ground beef, that's what you need to buy.
And it's cheaper when it's higher fat. So they're paying you to eat the good stuff.
Yep, 100%. Eat your ground beef. Get the 70-30, get even fattier if you can. That's often the cheapest beef in the grocery. And hallelujah for that. And then eat the hell out of some sardines like Word from the Sewer said.
Yep.
All right, Tucker, this has been amazing. Any final thoughts, final parting words? And then also tell us where we can find you.
Yeah, I just I just got married in June. My new wife has an autoimmune condition, fibromyalgia that she suffered from for decades. And when she was a near vegan, when we got back together 2 years ago, she was a near vegan. And I told her, you know, I don't like to get into arguments with vegans. She was a friend. She's a friend from high school. So, you know, we go way back. And she said, what do you eat? And I told her, avoid seed oils, refined carbohydrates and sugar, eat some animal fat and some, you know, eat animal protein and make sure you eat some animal fat. And, you know, I figured, okay, that's going to go right over her head because she's a vegan. A couple of weeks later, she calls me up and she says, okay, I'm eating the way you told me to. And I'm down 17 pounds already. She was down 56 pounds in 3 months, back to her high school weight. Because she could fit into her, you know, high school outfit. She was pretty stoked. Most importantly, she put her autoimmune disease into remission, right? After 30 years. So she was very happy. Now, what was really interesting was when we went to the Ancestral Health Symposium, we stayed in a hotel in LA. Just the little bit, I mean, we're really careful about our diets. I have to be. And she now realizes she does too. Just from the little bit of seed oil we got from eating in restaurants every meal, which you have to do in a hotel, brought her fibromyalgia back. And it brought the heel cracks back, which had healed. So, you know, for different people, you've really got to be cognizant of the effects and how careful you have to be. I'm very lucky. I'm super susceptible to this stuff. So it's really easy for me to stick on the straight and narrow. But, you know, it can take a little bit of experimentation. And I almost feel bad for people in a way who don't have the sort of reactions that I do or my wife does, because it's tough to stick to this stuff. It can be hard, but it's worth it. Nope, and I mean, totally, you know, I'm totally addicted to feeling great all the time now.
Me too. It's kind of cool.
It's kind of cool.
Thank you so much, Tucker. I put your links in the show notes, guys. Check out Tucker's blog. And if you really
want to get into on Twitter.
Get into a Twitter slap fight, go follow me and Tucker on Twitter and you're going to just, there'll be a slap fight at least once a day, I promise. Not between us, but us and others. So, yeah. Thanks a lot, Tucker. I certainly appreciate it, brother. You're welcome to jump in the comments and answer some if you want to. You're welcome to share. Maybe Tucker will follow me on Twitter now that he and I have done an interview together.
We'll see. Follow you on Twitter?
No, Tucker, you don't.
Oh, well, that's an oversight. That will be rectified immediately.
No worries, Tucker. Thanks so much, my friend.
Thank see you, Tucker.